Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two fabulous sponsors this week. One is Environments for Humans and their In Control conference that's coming up super quick in about a month, really, in February 17th through 19th in Orlando. We'll tell you more about that later in the show. And our new sponsor, DigitalOcean, a cloud hosting provider with starting at very affordable plans at $5 a month. Everything's in solid state drives. It's pretty sweet. Go to bit.ly/stsocean or just digitalocean.com. And we'll tell you more about their excellent hosting later in the show. But for now, let's kick things off.
Hello and welcome to season four of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front-end web design, development, and more. I am Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hi, everybody. We are back from our little holiday break, and it was lovely indeed. And with us, we have Liza Danger Gardner. Hi, Liza.
Hi there.
Yay.
Great.
So I guess we'll just do our normal thing. I feel like I got to stretch out, rub my shoulders a little bit here. It's been a while.
Yeah. I literally locked my computer in a safe for two
weeks.
You own
a safe.
The holiday. I own a safe because I was just like, well, if I'm leaving my house and all my computers and devices, it would suck to lose those. So put my computer in a safe. And I feel the best I've ever felt probably in my whole career. So
wow. That's a, so those great. Are big words.
Big yeah. words. I mean, I don't know if you guys get the opportunity to take a break ever, but it's so nice to just cut it. Just off. Yeah. Nope. Can't even do it. It feels good.
Lovely. So we have we should do the let's get to know Liza like hour here. Cloud Four. The more you know. Cloud Four is your baby.
Oh yeah. I'm a co-founder and I'm CTO at Cloud Four, where we help our organizations create responsive web applications and help larger organizations with more complex responsive design problems.
Nice. So it's like a dev shop. It's an agency.
Yeah. We are a motley group of people who are just really into mobile and pan device stuff and making stuff work in as many places as we can.
Yeah. Right on. So it's straight up development work. Somebody comes to you and says, we need help with this and you do it or work with their existing team or whatever. And then consulting as well. Like maybe we don't need you to write code, but we could have you. Could you please tell us how we could write code better? Does that happen?
Yeah, we're really adaptable in terms of our engagements. It depends on sort of the needs of the organization. Sometimes we go all the way bottom to top and deliver a functional technical product. Other times we come in and help teams, whether it's using words to teach or showing people how to proverbially fish in the responsive yeah. world. Or if it's even just more of education, speaking, writing, we just kind of love to spread the veritable gospel of the web and the mobile web. So we have a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, that's great. And I mean, there's a blog that goes with Cloud Four where you and the whole team just write constantly about it. It's an amazing resource. Just that, I'm sure that helps get some work occasionally. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we should really blog more even than we do. And, you know, we're just so busy all the time. But, yeah, we try to blog. And, you know, a number of us have other places that we're publishing and helping out with. I have a column on A List Apart now about once a month, which is really exciting for me. So
that is awesome, really. A monthly.
Yeah.
That's kind of a new format for them, I feel like. It's been like two articles a month forever. But now they have a little more different format, I guess.
I kind of love it because it gives me a chance to contribute to A List Apart, which is an amazing publication, without feeling like every work needs to be a total thesis, because the main articles are such works of art, such profound things that it's almost intimidating to jump into that sphere. But the ability to write a column, which is somewhat formal, but not nearly as formal as the overall article. So it's
what's it going to be about? Do you even, or is it just whatever? Is it they just want you to write so it can be about whatever?
Well, I'm on the track of, I think my tagline is building the web everywhere.
Oh, nice.
Oh, your latest post or whatever, it was the Never Heard of It, where you kind of just talk about
I did read that. That was excellent.
Fear of missing out, always being on the tie. And you're basically like, I have a life. That's sort of like how you respond to this question.
I don't even really have a life, but even if, you know, even without a life, I don't have time to keep up on everything.
You have the possibility of having one, should one come about.
Yeah, exactly. I have a bit of a life, but those of us running tech companies get a little sucked in from time to time. And I won't give away exactly what my next topic is, but I will have a column publishing likely next week, and it will be a little more technical in nature.
Nice. Cool. It sounds like that tagline is a little bit like, so I don't know. Okay, how do I phrase this in the right way? Cloud4, when you go to your site, are not afraid of the word mobile at all. The word mobile is all over it. But I feel like sometimes when you go to conferences and it sounds like on a list of whatever, they're kind of like going out of their way to not say the word mobile.
Actually, that was me. Because the original idea was to have, maybe the mobile web person. I think that And this doesn't necessarily reflect on Cloud4 or List Apart or anything. I think that I have sort of started moving beyond necessarily attaching the label mobile to myself, just because I think that mobile is really incredibly important. But in the end, it's a symptom of the web and the web's journey, and it's not an endpoint. So I don't want to stop at mobile and look at everything through a lens that's entirely mobile. I want to look through the lens of things working in as many places as they possibly can via the web.
Yeah, so philosophically different than I don't know.
Pinhole. On the other hand, I don't want to get into like some sort of deep semantic, wrangling and being pedantic over it. It just feels natural to me to try to find a slightly more expansive way of describing what I do.
You said mobile, but what about narrow screens?
Exactly. Oh my God. Are tablets mobile and like our gaming consoles, handheld game consoles? Is that a mobile device? Yeah.
I have a PSP, but I put my own screen on it. So therefore.
But when it's plugged in, it's
iPhone,
not.
I have an iPhone, but I've never removed it from my desk. Therefore, not mobile.
Ugh.
I like the Cloud4 blog. You and Griggs do really good work. I call him Griggs.
That's fine. But, he doesn't mind.
I feel like it's the big questions. And I don't know if you guys set out to do that, but it's always the place where like kind of big questions like what are we doing about responsive web apps or what are about responsive images? And you didn't want to talk about that. But like that's like kind of – I feel like it's become an unintentional home, or maybe intentional on your part, but for these big questions about the problems of responsive design.
I think it has to do with the personalities of all of the founders of Cloud4, beyond Jason and myself, also Aileen Jeffries and John Keith, and also our phenomenal staff, Tyler and Megan, and other people who work with us. We're kind of thinkers in that way. And I think when we founded Cloud4, we were looking in a very futuristic way out. And because we spend so much time researching the topics we have to keep up on, it gets to a point where you kind of have to synthesize it into a big grand point, or you're going to lose your mind over the details. And I think especially Jason Grigsby really leads in terms of strategic thinking, really shapes some of those ideas. And it's really exciting. It's also scary. And I think it has to do a little bit, at least for me, as to why I don't have even more blog posts on our blog. It's just like, every time I do it, I feel like I really need to have my points together, because we do have so many people who interact with us via the blog. And, I hesitate to put less useful stuff out there. But that's been one of the most rewarding parts about working with Cloud4, is how we're able to have that relationship with the tech community. It's been really exciting.
Awesome. Cool.
So did you buy a Fitbit?
Are you serious? Yes, I actually purchased a Fitbit 2 days ago. I expect to see it sometime in about 2016. They're heavily back ordered. I did one of those like serious Google depth searching of like, is there anywhere way I can possibly find it elsewhere? My boyfriend offered to hack his existing little web app he wrote to mine Target's inventory on a like second by second basis and send SMSs if one were to pop up somewhere. But I'm just not quite, I'm lazy. So I ended up just ordering it knowing it's going to take several weeks to show up, by which point, of course, I'll probably have given up on trying to be healthy.
But did you go flex or force or force. One force?
The force, because I'm really excited about the upcoming feature of the call notification, wherein you can be wearing this bracelet, and if you have a phone call come in on your device, it will vibrate for you. And I miss like 90% of incoming calls because my phone's never like right next to me. So it's weird that that would be the killer feature, but it kind of is.
Wow, I didn't know that was coming. That's pretty cool, though. Yeah, I would think you could get a flex because they just have been around forever. But yeah, Force is the new cool one. I got it. It did take forever to ship, but I also ordered it like 3 4.
Hey, guys, me too.
Did you really?
Me too.
Yeah, I think.
Let's be friends.
It came late. It came late, but yeah, it takes. It's interesting. I think. Yeah, I lead such a sedentary lifestyle. I need any sort of encouragement I can get. So
There's an API too, so you can like that's an encouraging thing to like nerd out with.
I'm bummed because I only have an iPhone 5, not a 5S, and definitely. I went and looked at it. Their newest iOS apps emphasize the M7 chip in the 5S for doing more advanced tracking. So, pity.
I should probably upgrade my phone then, and
That's right.
Get a $600 obesity tracker. Oh, man.
So in the news, we don't actually have a lot from news. We have a thank you. Can you play that, Dave? Or is that thought that was kind of a nice New Year thing.
Let me pull that up.
Sure, I'll talk about something else.
A little bit of drama that happened.
There was a little bit
recently.
It was, I think the web took kind of a drama break over Christmas, which was kind of nice. But the latest that came up, and I don't know necessarily I would qualify this as drama because I think most people are in agreement with, but it started with a post by Jeff Croft who wrote a post called Web Standards Killed the HTML Star. Did you read that one, Liza?
You know, I confess that I have been under extreme project and client duress this week and I'm hopelessly
good. That's better.
Yeah, whoops.
On your web reading. No, it was Jeff wrote about how this is, it's not even that long of a post. So anybody out there that's like, ugh, reading, don't worry about it. It's only like 4 paragraphs long. But
reading, why? Yeah.
So much words.
I know. Where's the tweet version? It's like that. So we went through this web standards movement back in the day, right? And it kind of gave birth to some like the web standards guru kind of, or somebody who was really good at HTML and CSS because they were there in the early days and fought the good fight. And now because that was so successful, there really isn't like a web standards like movement anymore, really, because like we're all in. Everybody agrees that that was a good idea, even the browsers. Like web standards are just a thing now, right? So that like, if I don't know, if you were like birthed during that era, that's not like good enough anymore. Like if you were just an HTML and CSS guru or whatever, that's kind of a commoditized skill now. Like that's not enough to be good.
Now you have to be Backbone, Angular, Node.
Yeah, they like just expect a little bit more. And if you just roll into a job thing, and this is why we're bringing it up, because I'm just introing the article here and then we'll talk about it. Is that good enough to roll into an interview and just be like, all I do is HTML and CSS. I'm real good at it, but that's all I can do, period. Would they just be like, not enough? What would happen at Cloud4 if somebody, if that was their only skill set was HTML and CSS and you were happened to be hiring, or is that a position that you would ever hire for?
That's a challenging question because I don't think that there's anyone who only does HTML and CSS in as a as a physical human being, because everyone has other things that they're good at just like innately. So, if we're hiring for what we might call, you know, design or production position, if your only actual technical skills were HTML and CSS, but you were a hell of an illustrator and you knew how to communicate to clients and how to put together thoughts from big, vague, strategic input and can, also build project plans, help the team out in various ways that way, or maybe you're really talented at documenting things, I think it's quite possible, actually. So in general, Cloud4, I would say, doesn't hire strictly on skill sets ever, because we're looking for someone who can really contribute to the team. On the other hand, I hear the premise, because it did used to be enough to be like, hey, I can totally code up a table for you and, you know, do a spacer GIF and we're all good. Whereas I do think it seems to be natural now for even front end implementers and designers to have their fire hose receiving thing open all the time and are always getting new information from the web. And naturally people's skills just grow because they're exposed to things. So I think that it's, I wouldn't tend to focus on that, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are all excellent points. If you like that, I don't know, you'll grow, and that's not, I don't know, you can't live in a bubble. It's not like you wake up and you only open an HTML editor and do that you're, I especially like the part about, I don't know, that if you can take a vague document and turn that, you're a good communicator essentially. And there's all those, you know, soft skills. I did air quotes there because that's such a weird word, but are actually rather important and stuff. Okay. So then there was the Zeltman response that was, I feel weird when I have to summarize articles for people, because I feel like I do it poorly, but it was a lot of agreeing, but slightly extending his own thoughts, and that indeed the web standards movement, the point of it was so that it didn't have to exist anymore. And that happened, but it happened really well. And I don't know that it was never intended to be a job is to be so siloed like that. I don't know. Maybe I poorly represented both of those people, but feel free to read them.
I mean, when the web standards movement started, right, I don't think anyone expected the JavaScript comeback, to be honest.
No, I shouldn't. Right? I remember the day I broke up with JavaScript in like 1999. It was like never again. And now I'm like programming in JavaScript 2/3 of the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I just, that was unforeseen, you know. And then all these other people, a lot of like classically trained computer scientists and people with degrees, they, you know, brought their like back end architecture knowledge into JavaScript, and bada bing, bada boom, it's a big success now. And that's kind of what you need to do your job sort of now.
Oh. Yeah. I think I would take slight question with the notion that the web standards movement is either over or no longer needed. But maybe I have a different conception of what it is. I think it's still really important for the people who are driving that to keep the momentum going, because I don't have total faith that it would just stay on the rails entirely without people still putting their hearts and souls into it.
Right. So it's I don't know, maybe everybody kind of agrees that it's good, but there's still risk of it going off the tracks. So people need to be like kind of ever vigilant of it not doing that. Be a way to say
I think that, there's a few things that are naturally likely to keep it in place. Market realities are such that if the browser situation fragmented terribly again, no one has quite enough monopoly in the browser space to win necessarily quite as handily as in times in the past. And if there was that much fragmentation, especially with mobile and other devices, developers wouldn't be able to develop for those platforms, and the manufacturers would end up losing out if they don't stick with the web standards bandwagon, as it were. So there's, I think, a little bit of market reality that will tend to steer things towards simplification, unification, and standards. But I don't think it's a simple thing, knowing what I do know about the web standards process, which is minimal. But I do know personally quite a few people involved, and it's still a really complicated field, and there's a lot of things that go on that are pretty intense. And I just really hope that those people keep marching the good march, as it were.
Hey, I hope so. I bet it's such a thankless job, kind of.
It really is. It really does seem that way. And the people I know who do it, who work, you know, for the W3C or contribute in other ways, are incredible in that they persist and they just keep going and going and don't let the bastards get them down, mm-hmm. as it were.
We should send fruit baskets,
pound cakes or fruit cakes. So I have that call that we got in, a really nice call in from Lawrence Dorman. One second. Here we go.
Hi, Chris and Dave. My name's Lawrence. I'm British, but I live in Paris in France. I haven't got a question. I'd just like to say thank you, because a year ago, I left university with an arts degree, and there didn't seem to be anything interesting I could do with that. I set about learning all I could about web development, and you guys have been with me every step of the way. All the most interesting stuff I used, like Sass and Compass, Grunt.js, and static site generators, I heard about on your show first, and I've just been offered my first proper job as a front-end web developer. Thank you, guys. Keep up the good fight. Bye. Love you.
Congratulations.
Aww.
Congratulations. That's a great way Yay. To kick off the new year here. Hopefully, you get to keep that job because of some of the facts you've learned on this show.
Yeah.
We're big on facts here. Yeah, that's cool. Awesome. Anytime you guys have feedback or whatever like that, we like to hear it. It's obviously good to know we're not just talking to ourselves here. So,
but look. Grunt, I heard Grunt was dead this week.
I heard
Grunt
that
is
too.
Dead this week.
Yep,
I just kind of wanted to throw myself off my balcony.
Totally dead.
Floor.
It's all about Gulp.
Just
downloaded it. What's
you guys,
Grunt replacement?
Duh. Gulp for life.
Gulp.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It does.
I'm
it does.
Everything I'm doing and go take all of my projects and move them to Gulp right now. Chop, chop. I'm so tired. It just makes me so tired.
Can we go 1 week without a technology dying?
No, this is my stock and trade, you guys. I, you know, and
exactly.
It is
you
for
thrive
you.
On the deaths of things.
I do kind of. And then I reject it at first, just as a matter of course, you know, just be like, ugh, I'm never going to use that. And then I wait for everybody else to figure out all the hard parts for it. And then I write a blog post about how it was hard. I rejected it at first, but then I came around to it because it turns out that it really was kind of awesome. But
that's,
you know,
right. That blog post with the most amazing title ever. I loved it. The Grunt for people who think things like Grunt are hard and
that's
weird.
My next year's title is Gulp for people who think things like Gulp are weird and hard. That's it's already yeah. written.
It just writes itself.
Anyway, I still like Grunt and whatever. I get the points.
I like it.
What about Gulp? Okay. Grunt, but slightly different. Is that good?
That's pretty good.
I kind of, having not dived into Gulp at all or looked at the differences between them for further than a couple of light layer blog posts, I kind of wonder at this point, you know, like it seems like the way that especially the JavaScript front end stuff is moving forward in this very snowballing way. I wonder if it's going to get to a point where we break a bit and instead of introducing new technologies or frameworks every week or two, and this is not the harsh on Gulp at all. I actually think it could be awesome. I have no idea. But it just reminded me of this. Like, is there going to be a point at which we kind of come back and coalesce and instead of inventing new wheels every week, we kind of try to perfect some of the existing wheels and build communities around the wheels? And I don't know. I feel like this, if we continue to amplify and magnify and accelerate change as much as we are, we're going to get to a point where no one can keep up. But maybe I'm just getting old.
No, I like it. I feel like we should have like fixthewheels.js. I'll start a GitHub repo right
now. There you go.
Oh, boy.
Okay, right. Let me do a sponsor and then we'll do the questions.
I think the big thing, right, is it looks like I don't even know. It looks like there's kind of some buzz around Gulp. So we should say Gulp is not.
Yeah, I'm sure it is awesome. We all agree that it might be awesome.
It might well be awesome. I have no idea.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Next.
Welcoming DigitalOcean as a sponsor. Thanks for sponsoring people. There, it is DigitalOcean.com, but there's all those like fancy URL parameters that make it look like you came from Shop Talk. So it'd be kind of cool if you use bit.ly.com or, you know, no, bit.ly or whatever, /STSOcean. Anyway, and if you use coupon code ShopTalk10 with them, you get $10 off them. And what's cool about that is that their lowest plan on DigitalOcean is $5 a month. So it's like 2 free months on them. And normally I'd be a little skeptical of like super wicked cheap hosting like that, but this really is a good hosting company. This is their little blurb about it, is that if you're looking for flexibility, power, customization offered by cloud hosting, but love the simplicity of shared hosting, check out DigitalOcean. They're, you know, I don't know. I don't even feel like reading the rest of that. Sorry, DigitalOcean, but I want to get to the important parts, is that you can start up a new server in 55 seconds. They have their timed up thing. It's super fast. If you go and set up, it's not like you have to like wait a day and then they send you an email that says like your server's been provisioned and all that junk. It just happens super, super quickly. For that $5 a month, you get 512 megabytes of RAM, a 20 gigabyte SSD. All of their servers are on SSDs, which is pretty cool. It's that solid state hard drive, which means it's wicked fast. You know, your disk doesn't have a spinning thing that just feels ancient these days. And you get a CPU to yourself and a terabyte of transfer for $5 a month. It almost seems like it's like a loss leader for them, and that's like a good chunk for $5 a month. Anyway, they have one.
But it gets better.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, there's lots of good stuff in here. You can go look at it. They have data centers all around the world. They have one-click installs of WordPress, obviously, because everybody loves that. But they have Ghost now already in there and Ruby on Rails, ooh, just one-click stuff. It's pretty nice. $5 a month, click a button and have a Ghost blog that's self-hosted. Pretty good. Anyway, check out DigitalOcean. bit.ly/STSOcean. STSOcean.
I said, and we have a $10 code here, right?
Yeah, it's Shop Talk 10.
And $10 off, that's 2 months of awesome hosting.
Cool.
Awesome. Thank you, DigitalOcean. Let's move into the meat and potatoes of the Shop Talk show, the questions and the answers. Scott Little writes in, I'm curious to know how we as a community are handling touch events on mobile devices at the moment. Specifically, I'm referring to drop-down flyout menus. Is there a popular jQuery JS library you'd recommend? Cheers.
I feel like we've talked about this before a little bit, but it's kind of worth mentioning because there's so many websites that have a flyout menu, some kind of menu, and you know, mobile's a different world. I was like, you know what? I wonder if Cloud 4 has drop down menu kind of things, and you do. So I thought maybe we'll just put it in there, and maybe Liz would have some opinions on how.
So there is generally no one size fits all, which I have to say is a disclaimer. Some of the really smart people at Cloud 4 a few months ago put together an open source thing called Simple Slide View, which works with either jQuery or Zepto. It's agnostic to either, that does the off-canvas menu style of navigation pretty consistently and nicely across as many devices as we've been able to test on. You can find it on github.com under the Cloud 4 user, all one word, Cloud 4, and that is called Simple Slide View. And we at Cloud 4 do aim to try to release, you know, some more stuff in that sort of space over the next year. We're getting really excited about being able to put some stuff out there in the open source community. So that's been fun, and there's been lots of great feedback from the community that has gotten integrated into that work. A lot of work for that is done by Tyler Sticka at Cloud 4, who's an amazing star. So that's been exciting. So in terms of just touch events overall, boy, what a big question that is. Do you guys want to stab at that just a bit?
Well, perhaps. Anyway, shout out Tyler. Thanks for writing thanks for writing that, and thanks for writing the stuff you've done on CSS Tricks too. He did a post on his thing, and it sounds like you read it.
So awesome. Yeah, I did a little bit of reviewing, but I didn't really have anything too useful to add. That's all Tyler there. He's doing a great job on that.
High five. So. I think one of the things we've mentioned about flyout menus in the past is that if you have like an anchor link that has like a UL inside of it and then wrote a CSS selector that it was like a colon active UL display block or whatever to show it, and it was normally displayed none. That will work generally. It like will know that you that it's in its active state now and reveal that flyout menu. So you don't necessarily. I don't know about like the depths of the mobile OS world and how it works, but I think on your major iOS and Android stuff that kind of works okay. Maybe Dave has more to say.
No, I was just for like drop down menus. Yeah, your on click event is gonna be it's a tap basically. There are some touch things that happen before that you're gonna want to register and log, but more or less like hover and tap are the same thing. You're gonna have problems though. Like the biggest problem, at least that I've seen, is Windows 8, the IE browser, or in Windows 8. They have these pointer events, which are different than iOS's Touch Start and the things that Chrome and WebKit inherited. So you got to be kind of like proactive and really test on those devices too, because they kind of handle touch a little bit differently. Fire some different events there.
I mean, IE10. How do you use IE?
Yeah, IE10 plus. Sorry,
so IE10 on Windows 8.
Windows Phone. Yeah.
So be careful there. One thing I like to do if you want to add swipes to your page and stuff like that, because that's always good to do as well. But if you aren't interested in supporting Windows and or IE10 or whatever, that's fine. I always get the touch library, the touch part of jQuery Mobile, because it's really good. And it has like swipe left, swipe right events and stuff like that. It's really nice. If you need more than that, I recommend Hammer.js, Hammer.js. It's got a MC Hammer on it on the webpage. And that's like touch events for everything. But then I think it goes over 100K. It starts becoming kind of non-mobile at that point. So something to think about.
So one other thing I would add is if you're working with sort of basic touch events to do navigation things that aren't actually links, but to expose menus, et cetera, is for now you might consider using a simple little drop-in library or tool like FastClick.js to eliminate that 300 to 400 millisecond delay between the tap and the click event on those taps. It'll become less, I think, necessary in the future. You know, Chrome is already bragging that they're going to get rid of that delay in upcoming versions. And then to follow up on the Windows thing, I think that we tend to think of touch events in terms of the world of WebKit touch events. We get a little complacent between maybe the Android Chrome and the Android browser, Safari, Chrome on the desktop, all share generally the same kinds of touch events. But those touch events are indeed distinct from some of the touch events in IE or the other browsers. So that's something to definitely keep aware of and make sure you're testing on those. And also connected to that, if you're using a tool like Modernizer to test whether a device supports touch events or not, at least the last time I looked at Modernizer and touch events, which admittedly was about 8 months ago, that will return true if WebKit touch events are supported. So it's specifically looking for those WebKit ones. Just something to know. It will tell you like a Windows Phone doesn't have touch capacity.
Oh, so it'd be like it would say false, even though it has some kind of touchability. Yeah.
And I wanted to correct something I said earlier. I was talking about something that Cloud4 had released in the open source. The one I was actually meant to talk about is actually called Off Canvas Menu, not the simple slide view. They're related but slightly different. Anyway, you can sort of poke around in our public GitHub and repositories and find whatever it is you're looking for there.
Cool.
Yeah.
Don't hesitate to set up like some code pens and just see how things work, you know, like just test it in mobile devices, you know. I don't think there's like a one that's going to fix all your worries if you did something weird, but yeah. There you go.
Yeah, and make sure you test it again after you've integrated it with your complicated markup, because I know that some of the deeper bugs we had to dig out of Off Canvas Menu only manifested in certain combinations of markups, so it's always fun.
Yeah, there's even things beyond that, like Windows Phone, older Windows phones and stuff. They don't do animations well, like in Androids. They'll just crash if you try to like slide something out as opposed to just appear it.
Right.
So that gets weird too. Something to think about. All right. Next question.
There's a bunch of good minis. We just released the top 100 most popular pens of 2013 at codepen.io/2013/popular. And there's a bunch of like takes on menus there. Yeah, there is an ad on that page. But it's it's kind of interesting to see. And there's a number of menus in there too. And that was kind of a trend this year, is like, I'm going to come up with a new way to do a mobile menu or a small screen menu anyway. Oh, anyway, we got one from here from Tim Evco. He says, every now and then my job requires me to code an HTML email template. I usually have to look online to see what email clients can and can't handle. But lately I've been getting a lot of contradictory answers. For example, is it okay to put all of the CSS in a style tag somewhere in there and then use classes? Or does everything need to be inlined still? Which CSS3 features are supported? Yada, yada, yada. Ask a bunch of questions. Is there something like caniuse.com for email stuff? Tim asks. To which I would say, yes. What do you...
Email templating makes me cry.
Yeah. That's why I think stuff like Campaign Monitor and MailChimp will just be awesome forever, because it's just like, just log in and use one of our little templates, and they're guaranteed to work because that's our business, and they'll be responsive, and you can just use our nice little editor to make a real nice email, and the deliverability will be really good. And they're not even a sponsor for us, but I feel like that's why it's so tempting to use those, because they solve all these sucky problems for us. But Tim, there is kind of a can I use for email stuff, and Campaign Monitor puts it together. It's just campaignmonitor.com/CSS, and it's just a huge grid of what's supported and what's not. And I know how tempting it is to use classes, because, you know, that's the abstraction that we need when designing things, is a class. But unfortunately, you can't still, and Gmail being the big holdout there. So you need to inline all of your styles. I think MailChimp has a tool for that. Like, if you just are like, screw it, I'm using classes, too bad, you can design it that way, copy and paste your document, drop it in there, and it will figure it out and inline it for you, which is nice. So that way you're like, as an author, you can still use classes. But right before you send it, you can just inline everything, which is cool. Any other thoughts on email stuff?
No.
I'm the worst to ask. I avoid it at all costs. Comes up, I'm like, maybe you should hire somebody. But I agree with Chris that start with their template and just make minor modifications, or else it's a world of hurt. I don't think there's a harder part of web development. Possibly, am I crazy? Like. Mm.
I think it's incredibly hard. I don't touch it. You know, at Cloud4, Aileen Jeffries, our design director, is sort of magical at that. We actually call her the IE Whisperer in general, but it extends to Outlook. So
IE Whisperer.
Mostly at Cloud4, we overlap in almost everything, but on that one, just hard line between me, in the sand between me and email, because it scares the crap out of me.
Here's a hot tip for your email. Why don't you keep it real, real simple? Because nobody loves their HTML email anyway. You know, it's like, God, I can't wait till I get the next email from Target that's like 500 pixel by 500 pixel red circles with like a wicker chair in it or whatever. You know, like, I much prefer emails that are like two really straightforward sentences, you know? And I kind of understand some need for a little bit of branding, like, oh, maybe there should be a little red circle up in the corner when you get an email from Target, so it's very clear who it's from or whatever. You can do that type of stuff in HTML without running into the really difficult problems that you know, a more complex email would have, you know, like multiple columns and, you know, rounded boxes and all that stuff. Can you just not do any of that? You might consider that actually might be more effective for your email anyway.
Ugh. Yeah. The guys in the chat room are recommending Ink from Zurb. It's like responsive email templates nice. That you can get started with. But yeah, I agree with you. The ones that I like, that I get and I like, the HTML emails, it's usually just like a C frame. Are you guys familiar? Do you use that term? But like, it's like the header, or it's the thing that wraps around the text content or whatever. Like Apple sends out a good one.
I don't get it. One more time.
Sorry. It's the stuff. It's like the header and the footer and maybe the
C clamp. That's what we call
C clamp. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's just the C shape around your content or whatever.
I see. That's cool.
Like if you do a very simple one of those and then just straight up like normal text, it looks really beautiful. So I've been impressed.
I like it.
I recommend going that route. Anyway, next question. Shall we?
We shall.
All right. Linda Fan writes in and she's a fan of the show. Oh, I'm so sorry. Linda,
that was all
waka, 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 waka.
Sorry, Linda. It was there. I had to take it. Okay. Is it possible and how can one avoid code redundancy, dry violations when supporting non-media query browsers like IE8 and below during responsive design implementation?
Let's take a pause there real quick.
Okay.
So has to support IE8. Is wanting to, but other browsers above that as well in their capabilities. And she's worried about dry. And when she says dry, she means don't repeat yourself in CSS, right? She doesn't want to have a style sheet that she authors just for IE8 and then a different style sheet just for everything else because there's so much shared stuff. So she's worried about having to maintain two different style sheets that share a lot, but are different. And a lot of her point is that she's mentioning responsive design and IE8 doesn't have media query support. So now I'll continue with her points to consider.
Okay, for points to consider, one, for performance reasons, we want to avoid Respond.js or we avoid Respond.js. Two, a common response is usually mobile first, giving IE8 a half column mobile view. If browsers can't do media queries, they'll just get the base layout, which will be your tube of content. This is fine for most public sites, but not for our corporate ones. Most of our client work is for internal corporate use, so
she's like an IE8 first scenario. Like you can't just do the like fallback, oh, just give them the based content, just give them like some nice typography and a single column and call it a day. That's not acceptable for Linda.
These are mobile applications on an intranet of sort.
And remember, the main problem being that she wants to like design for IE8 and have this nice style sheet, but then like have another version of that same site that does have a bunch of media queries in it and fancier stuff for the browsers that can support it. So I don't know. Did we frame that well? I feel like that's a weird position to be in. Like you have to give a really
good. It's complicated. But I think there's a few things. One is that you could look at the notion of mobile first and adapt it a bit in terms of the requirements of that particular project and sort of look at it more like baseline first, which is designing for the biggest consumer of that content. And in that case, IE8 might be kind of your baseline. So your baseline without media queries might not be your content tube. It may be something more appropriate for an IE8 desktop browser, something to kind of consider. And another thing to consider in terms of technically being dry is there's quite a bit of cleverness you can do with the newer versions of SAS and then also your workflow and pipelining in terms of not literally having to duplicate your code, but having a build process automatically put that in the various places it needs to go. So there's a little bit of stuff you could do there as well.
I think you're exactly right. I think you just do like gulp IE8 and then it just fixes it. But you do it.
The named breakpoints thing, I've seen that, and then there's like a IE8 flag or older IE flag that you can set. So like you basically generate two style sheets with one with IE8, the IE8 flag set true, and that will cull all the media queries. I've seen that kind of thing happen.
That's exactly nice. What I would do is you'd make it like an IE8.scss or whatever, or just like I wouldn't even name it IE8. I would name it like does not cut mustard.scss or whatever.
Yeah.
And then like good browser or just style.css.
Just styles.css.
Right. Because it's styling anyway. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, then have like a variable at the top of that file on each one of them. One of them says, media queries true or media queries false, or maybe even some kind of other abstract word that basically means do less. And then include your global or whatever. Just do add import global And then because that variable set one way or the other, you can kind of use that so anyway, the only one that you're maintaining as an author is global.scss. And within that, there's like if then kind of stuff going on, or your mix-ins, and use that variable right. to output less stuff.
You only have to maintain the delta. You don't have to maintain actually two copies of it. So yeah, you stay dry. Exactly. I think that this emphasizes something that I've been thinking about a lot lately. And I'm going to be doing some writing and talking about it in the upcoming months, is that how now to go back to HTML and CSS as skills might not be enough in our marketplace, is how workflow and build processes have become totally essential to getting our job done.
Yeah.
And it's really challenging for a lot of us. I know myself included, in that I like the idea that I can work with just a text editor and a browser and just, you know, save and reload. And the reality has become such that just doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. Is that kind of a take on the DevOps world or whatever, that you're like tooling and stuff is so vital? No.
I think even just front end development, I think that it's rare to find a front end developer who isn't working in a shared environment, or, you know, maybe a distributed repository in which they've got grunt build processes, Bower components, Compass doing its magic, and like build processes as part of the project, and that it's becoming increasingly necessary for front end devs to be competent in those areas.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, to take this back to the beginning of the show, I think that's what Jeff was kind of saying, right? Is that you have that base skill of HTML and CSS, but like you kind of just need it all. You're going to need to know some Git.
I think there's an important differentiation, and I mentioned this in my list apart column about things I'd never heard of, or I'd never heard of it, is that there's an important thing. I think the skill that underlies this is actually the ability to figure out how to do things. It's not necessarily the actual skill of grunt, right? It's about knowing how to go to the web and which tools are at your fingertips to be able to figure out, okay, I need to figure out how to use Bower now. How do I do that? And, you know, 20 minutes later, you're fine, right? So it's not necessarily the skill itself so much as knowing how to find things when you need them.
That's a perfect way to say it, I think. And it goes down to the micro level. I actually was thinking the other day, I have this as like a draft post that I'm thinking about writing, of like all of the different languages that I might touch in a day. And there's not a ton of them, but there's, you know, I don't know, 6, 7 maybe. Mm-hmm. And literally a for loop in all of them is different. And then sometimes it's like really different. You know, it's like how I don't even have them all memorized.
What always gets me every day, I have the same thing. The concatenation operator in different languages kills me every time.
Oh, it's a dot in PHP, but it's a plus
in
JavaScript.
I write a lot of PHP. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It just gets me.
I have a plugin that I broke yesterday because I was plus doing strings in PHP. I was like, what is wrong? This is totally right. I'm like, oh, period. Worst operator ever. Anyway, okay, let's do another question.
Well, in PHP, like if you add var, everything falls.
Yeah, don't var out. Yeah, that's a white screen if I've ever seen one.
Whoops.
I better do another sponsor. Sorry. Actually, maybe this will be, because Dave's talk on the In Control conference website is still to be determined. So we don't even know.
Actually,
is it determined now?
It announced just now.
Did it?
Yeah. I'm going to be talking about this sort of stuff, like automating your tool chain and stuff like that.
Are you really?
Just kind of getting into just all that little bit.
Mm. You might have to install Gulp then. Might be.
I might have to gulp it out. So we'll see. Oh, no. It's the same
thing. Front end tooling, though, is the point.
I'm a big fan of building your own tools and. So I'm going to talk about that, and kind of from the like point, kind of similar to your article, Chris, about, you know, grunt for people who don't like grunt, just people who fear the command line. So that's kind of where I'm coming.
Nice. So if you want to see this talk that's apparently never been given before and is possibly still in the idea stage.
Possibly going to fail miserably.
No, but you have a while. Career. You have a good 6 weeks to flush this all out. At the In Control Conference. So incontrolconference.com. It'll take you to 2014.incontrolconference.com. It's February 17th through 19th. So when you hear this, you have about 5 weeks. So you better get on the bandwagon, start convincing the powers that be at your place, or counting your change, or flipping the couch cushions or whatever, because you're going to want to go to this, especially if it's absolutely freezing like it is here in the Midwest. The idea of being in Florida sounds very awesome right now. Keynotes by Scott McCloud. Christopher Schmidt told us when I saw that he was keynoting, he's like, have you read Understanding Comics? That's Scott McCloud's like famous book about comics, which I hadn't, and I ordered it, and it's awesome. So I unfortunately can't be there at this, but I'm reading Scott's book, and it's so good, and it makes me jealous of all you people that are going to go and listen to him speak. Daniel Ryan is doing a keynote. He was the front-end developer lead on the Obama campaign, so that should be pretty cool. And a bunch of other names that you've seen here on Chop Talk before, so get your butt down to Orlando, February 17th through 19th. There's workshops and stuff. It's the whole in-person conference affair, and you can save $100 with coupon code SHOPTALK. So enjoy. Have fun, Dave. Have fun, everybody.
It's going to be good.
Let's do the Tracy Rotten one.
All right, here we go. Let me see if I got it into it.
Hi, Chris and Dave. I'm a fairly recent convert to using CSS preprocessors, and now that I've started playing around with what they can do, I can't ever see me going back to writing straight CSS. At first, I picked less over Sass because I know nothing about Ruby, and less's barrier to entry seemed lower on that point. But Sass seems so much more powerful, especially when working with responsive design, so now I'm switching and working all with Sass. However, what I still don't understand is what Compass actually is and how it works with Sass. It doesn't seem to be a requirement, strictly speaking. I keep hearing and reading about all these great things you can do with Compass as Sass, but I'm not sure exactly how to use Compass to do these things, and the documentation on Compass's website is a bit lacking. Can you please explain a bit about what Compass is, how to use it, and what makes it so great? Thanks so much. Love the show.
All right, so Tracy, less convert to Sass, now doesn't understand quite what Compass is. Liza, do you have any tips?
You know, I've actually had a similar conundrum in the way past when I first encountered Compass. I was almost at the point of dropping them an email and be like, wow, you guys would really profit if you, not that it's a for profit type of gig, but if you had like a one or two sentence at the top that was a little clear about what it does, because it extends the capabilities of Sass. And I think that the core things that Compass does that's nice is it reduces the sort of rote sort of things you have to do to create CSS rules that apply across browsers and platforms. So I think that I remember having the same conceptual roadblock when I first encountered Sass. I'm like, wait, how does Sass relate to Compass and vice versa? Compass extends Sass. It is as said, not at all a requirement, but mostly I find devs are using it 90% of the time who are using Sass. So I think it's a library of useful, repeatable things, you know, so you don't have to write gradient syntax and such stuff. I mean, does that generally cover it, you guys? What do you think?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And I couldn't agree more that the compass-style.org has some kind of copywriting issues there and could do a lot better there. I know that's a point of, a sore point a little bit for Chris Epstein, who's been on the show and is the maintainer and creator of Compass, who really likes the Compass site. And Chris, there's a lot of things that this site does well. And I'm sure the build process for it is super cool, and it's nice how it exposes all the code and stuff, but it needs somebody to come in like a content strategist or even just straight up a copywriter or both to just come in and be like, can you explain this a little easier?
Yeah. The good news is once you have your head around the concept, the Compass site is perfectly great for like documenting the actual methods you're using or the mix-ins you're using, excuse me. It's not bad once you know kind of your way around as a reference site. It's fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of. But like here's an example. Does Compass have a box sizing mix-in or not? I don't know. I can't remember. I'm going to go up here and I'm going to go search the docs. I'm going to go box sizing. And then it says like there's kind of some weird result, but the results Compass box sizing. Okay, I'm going to click that. And then it says like this is how you have to import it. And it has Compass CSS3 box sizing. You're like, okay, so but if I'm already importing /CSS3, do I get that or not? That's not really clear. And then it doesn't show me a code example of what that actually – how to actually use it. It's just totally not there on this page. Like that's got to be fixed. I feel like there should be an example
sometimes
of what it is.
There's a way to see the code that is actually the code that generates the mix in at some point, you know, that's like the source, mix-in code.
As it were.
Yeah, the source code.
I think in this camp, it has an example, and then you click examples, and then it takes you to a little page that has it, and that's kind of cool. I mean, that it works, and you can see the output too, which is nice. Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to like turn this into a crap talking van Compass, but a lot of people agree that this is an issue with Compass, and it's not totally clear, and it could probably be fixed by, I don't know, smart, and it's open source, so you could possibly make those contributions right through GitHub if you were so inclined. Anyway,
the way I think of it is SAS is Dora the Explorer, right?
Okay.
And Compass is Dora's backpack, right? Which gives
really good,
which has all the. It's a backpack full of superpowers and tricks. Okay, it's easy.
Got it. Oh, that was actually really good. It was better than I thought it was going to be. It is, as Liza said, it just extends the capabilities of SAS. And as 90% of people that use SAS, which I would think that this is.
By the way, that's a highly
true.
Unscientific number.
No, absolutely, right? I would think
I'm pretty sure it's a fact. I just tweeted.
I bet it's a. I just.
Oh, great. Quote. I'm going to. It's really the rest of my life living that down.
I bet it's really high though, and the ones that aren't using it just use normal SAS for whatever reason, or use something like Bourbon or write their own mixins, which I would not recommend generally. Just because it's like Compass spent a lot of time on their CSS3 mixins that are really good. But here's the deal with that. If you're in the 90% asterisk people that use Compass with SAS, I feel like 90% of those people use Compass because of all the CSS3 stuff in it. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's why. I think it's like SAS doesn't help you with CSS3, but Compass does. So that's why you would use it, right? But it helps you with vendor prefixing when I say CSS3. And vendor prefixing, I feel like it should be moved away to the tool auto prefixer because it does an amazing job at it. And it does it in such a way that it doesn't need to be updated when stuff changes like Compass does. So I really encourage people to check out auto prefixer and make that a part of their build process instead of using Compass for their CSS3 stuff. And I think Compass almost sort of kind of agrees with that. I think they're going to move their vendor prefixing to the same thing that auto prefixer does, which is like go ask the internet basically what the support levels of CSS3 features are these days. You set the level of browser support that you want to achieve, and then it just automatically does it instead of how it does it now, which just kind of has all these things kind of hard coded into it. So it, you know, it likes the auto prefixer approach, and it's probably Compass is going to leave that CSS3 stuff in there, but just do it in the same way. You can do that now. I would just, you know, if the only thing you use Compass for is CSS3 stuff, I would ditch it and use auto prefixer in a heartbeat. In fact, I have on all my projects, but Compass isn't just that. What Compass is moving towards, I'm not saying Compass is bad. Compass is amazing, and it was important part of the dev workflow. What it's moving towards is like less CSS3 stuff, but more of like little helpful functions that just help you. It's not because it's not just CSS3 stuff. It's all this other stuff. It has typography rules in it and like little grid helpers and all kinds of interesting. I think I've heard Chris say he wants to move it in that direction. Like I want to have more little helpful stuff that help front-end developers and people that make tools for front-end developers. That's what, get out of the CSS3 stuff, get into more of that stuff. So anyway. That's what Compass is.
Great job.
Oh, that's good. Awesome. Yeah, so hopefully that helped answer your question, Tracy. Do we have time for one more? Or let's see.
You got to scoot.
This one, Liza, do you have time for one more question?
I can do it. Yep.
No. All right, here we go. Weimar Whitby, coolest name in the universe, writes in, I understand that there is no right or wrong, so I'd love to hear your opinions on using a responsive design versus having a separate mobile site. One benefit I can see in a separate site subdomain is an MDOT, if you will, is the ability to control every single resource that gets sent to a mobile device. On the other hand, now there are two sites that need to be maintained. Your thoughts?
How many hours do we have left to discuss this? this one again.
Gut reaction.
Well, maybe just take it from the
Responsive is my gut reaction. we've done a lot of both in the past. And the reason I tend to fall towards responsive is this. One, you should be having complete control over every resource you're delivering to everyone anyway, on an idealistic level, because performance is important everywhere. We've got to focus on that. Two is general. I generally fall towards content parity, which is, you know, delivering the ability to get at the same content to everyone despite what they're using to access it. I feel that responsive has matured so much in the last few years that you're able to do things that you didn't used to be able to do, which is why we would tend to fall towards the mobile subdomains, et cetera, a separate site in the past. Device detection is not without problems. And also, oh gosh, I had one last thing and it has completely flown my brain. I will think of it. You guys talk.
That's okay. Yeah. I just was interested in kind of the general Cloud 4 approach. You know, if a client were to ask you that question, I guess what would you come back with? Or
I got one more, and it's sort of subtle, more subtle, but sharing of links. You know, I get people email me links all the time to articles and things on the web. And half the time when I click on them in my desktop email client, they open in Chrome on the mobile subdomain and look very strange.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. So, okay. So responsive as a gut reaction kind of thing. And Weimar, you even said in your question that the kind of the two code base thing is a pain in the butt too. So even if you were to decide to split off because there's more benefits in that way, I mean, you know, thinking of what it's like to use the site is one thing, but you know, you have to consider what your team is capable of too. And you know, essentially doubling your work might be not possible.
Yeah, anyway. And I think that, you know, I got to do this really lame wishy-washy thing where it's like, it totally depends on your project and your goals, but I have to say it because it's true.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. We can end with that. How about that?
Yeah. Woo!
Great. Perfect. Liza, thank you so much for taking time out of your day. What is one thing you'd like to plug, and then how can people get in touch with you, give you money? How does that work?
Get in touch. Please do come visit us at cloud4.com or read our blog at blog.cloud4.com. We've got, you know, a lot of exciting stuff coming up. I know that I'll be speaking at a couple of events this spring, including relevantly Breaking Development Conference in Dallas in late March. That's kind of late breaking information. And I'm really excited about that. In terms of plugging, I don't think I need to do much more, but, you know, keep an eye on Cloud 4. We're going to try to be pushing more stuff out into the community this year. We're really excited to be just increasing our expertise on responsive and responsive, also mobile and other things. And we're just having a blast, honestly. So much good stuff going on.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. And be sure to check out Breaking Development there. That sounds nice.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much for putting up with me and having me.
Cool. So everyone, thank you for coming in. Thanks to everyone who braved all the chat rooms today. We really appreciate that. All two of them. And thanks everyone for subscribing in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to rate us in your favorite iTunes like thing. And Chris, do you have anything else?
ChopTalkShow.com.